Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues. But for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi everyone, this is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.
Hi there, and welcome to our show, The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. I'm Bianca Murray, and I'm joined by Carly Waters and Cece Lira from PS Literary Agency. Hi everyone, welcome to another episode of The Shit No One Tells You About Writing. We're very excited today to have a returning guest who was on the podcast with us for her last novel, which was her debut. So she has earned her MFA in creative writing from Emerson College and has had her work published in the New York Times, the Wall Street Journal, and more. Her debut novel, Dava Shastri's Last Day, was a Good Morning America book club pick and is currently in development as a television series for HBO Max. She lives with her husband in New York City. It's my pleasure to welcome Kirthana Ramasetti. Kirthana, welcome back to the show.
Thank you so much for having me. I'm happy to be back.
And I am now, this is Cece speaking, hijacking this episode. Everyone must listen to me now. Bianca has no idea I'm doing this, by the way. We just introduced Kirthana, but I'm going to put her on the spot. Kirthana, tell our lovely listeners how we know each other, specifically you and me.
Cece is one of the agents I queried for my debut novel, and I was very offered when she made me an offer of representation.
Was I the first to offer?
I believe you were the second or the third.
I tell the story wrong because I say I was the first. Okay. Why am I pointing this out? Because we have a very, very special community in our podcast. It's a community where occasionally one of us rejects the other. Carly and I have been queried by authors who we've offered representation to and signed. And sometimes people query us and we unfortunately pass on that project. And yet we're still a part of this amazing community because that is one of the things that makes publishing so unique. We're all in this together. We're all supporters of each other. We're all still super excited about seeing everyone succeed, even though we don't necessarily work together. And so for everyone who's listening, who's facing rejection at any moment, A, know that it happens at all levels. B, know that it doesn't change, not even for a second, how much people care about your project and how much we want you to succeed. And three, if I ever offer you representation, I will tell the story wrong of how the representation offer happened. And you can come on the podcast and correct me.
I love that. I love that, Cece. And on behalf of all the writers out there, can I just say, because we deal with so much damn rejection every day from agents. So it's awesome sometimes when the tables are turned and we see authors rejecting agents. So Kathana, there's a whole bunch of podcast listeners out there who are like, you go, girl. Okay. So before we discuss Advika and the Hollywood Wives, which is Kathana's sophomore novel, which we're going to get into, we're going to do some deep dives. We are going to dive right in today with our first query letter, and Carly's going to kick us off.
I also want to say on the thread that Cece just led us on is that somewhere in the episode today, I won't say where, somewhere in the episode today, there will be a book mentioned that I offered rep to and didn't get as well, that the author decided to sign with somebody else. So I won't say where, who, where, you know, as I said in the podcast, but listen up, everybody, and you will hear a book that I offered rep to, and it's in the comps of something that you will hear today. Okay, here we go. Dear Bianca, Carly, and Cece, I only just discovered your podcast, The Shit No One Tells You, and I am so glad I did. Not just for the fun and informative podcast itself, but for all the classes, workshops, and contests. Thank you so much for your thoughtful help with all of us newbies trying to figure out this world of publishing. And as you say, persistence. It is what pushed me to send the query letter below. The Healing Houses, my upmarket debut, complete at 100,000 words, told in two perspectives and two time periods, explores obsession, the dangerous power of charisma, and healing with artistic expression. I trust this will appeal to fans of My Dark Vanessa and the girls. 34-year-old Elaine Montague is an artist. She paints houses, houses with roots reaching into rocky earth, windowless houses tumbling through white water. Her art is her life and coping mechanism. 5 years in a cult, then 10 years in hiding, she believes Michelle, the charismatic leader of the Brotherhood and figure of her past obsession, has been searching for her, and perhaps still is. Now living in Colorado, her fifth state in 10 years, Elaine befriends Mary, a purported therapist, and finally feels safe enough to reveal some of the stories she's clutched tightly to for years. Fast forward a year, and Elaine's ex-boyfriend from the cult, James, is desperate to retrieve his wife and young daughter from the Brotherhood. Elaine's fear of being drawn back into the world and the toxic relationship she thought she'd finally let go of becomes real when she indeed becomes face-to-face with Michelle. Gathering her resources is imperative. She believes Mary was helping her, but with Mary suddenly under Michelle's spell, and the fact that her name is not even in the county records, Elaine wonders who she's dealing with. To keep her carefully built foundation from cracking, her focus on her dream solo art show at the prestigious Denver Gallery, she must dredge up the gems she learned from Michelle himself, gems that come with crippling memories. Some days the only safe place to stand is at her easel. While my business has been as a successful artist, I am also a longtime writer whose fiction and poetry have been published in such journals as Earth Daughters, Ravens, Perch, and The Harbinger. I was rewarded an honorable mention at the Solus Awards Traveler's Tales 2020-2021 for my short story, The Bathroom. I participated, 2020, in the Community of Writers, formerly Squaw Valley Writers Conference. Thank you for your time and consideration. Please see below the first 5 pages of The Healing Houses. Best, Liz Collins.
Awesome, Carly. Thank you. Okay, so can you give us an indication of word count there and then your take on that?
So there was a bit of a preamble, but altogether 456 words. Okay, so our title is a different font size. So just a reminder, your title should just be all caps, but the same font size. So 12 point, Times New Roman, all of that good stuff. Okay, and so in terms of the hook here, so we have dangerous power of charisma, healing with artistic expression, and then I'd add kind of like when X happens to Y at the kind of end of that little preamble about the obsession and the power of charisma, artistic expression, just kind of like build out that hook a little bit because it's still a little bit vague. Try to explain like when X happens to Y in that little part there. Next, I actually was a little bit confused about the painting logistics just from a, you know, just straightforward point of view, right? So we know that she's an artist, but then it says she paints houses. I thought it meant literally like, yes, she's an artist, but she paints the exterior of houses. And then I was like, oh, roots reaching into rocky earth. And I was like, wait a minute, what kind of houses are? And then I was like, are we in a fantasy world? Like, as I said, looking back, I'm like, it is straightforward. But the fact that I was so confused in the moment, maybe find a way to just explain, like, artistically that she paints houses on canvas and figure out a way to kind of explain that. Cause I thought we were talking about the exteriors of houses. And again, we don't need to stumble over anything for a reason like that. Okay. So now I'm thinking we have fast forward a year, Elaine's boyfriend, et cetera, et cetera. So why did the book start a year ago if it seems like we're just fast forwarding to where the plot begins? I'm a little bit confused about that. Also confused about why she's helping her ex-boyfriend. So like we have our plot points, but we're not really connected in terms of the why behind all of these, which just makes us think about why is this protagonist making the choices that they're making, right? So we kind of have to understand the stakes and the reasonings. I would try to find a way to weave these elements in so we understand with a bit more meaning what is happening, as opposed to just kind of like naming off plot points, because to me, they weren't very connected. And also like, why can't she just run away? Like, is she actually afraid for her life? Like, how do we actually spell out what's at stake here? The fact that she can't show her art collection, I mean, that is very serious for an artist, but is this life and death that we're kind of up against here with this cult? How dangerous is Michelle? Because in this last paragraph we have, you know, carefully built foundation from cracking. Like, these are vague things, and I understand that you're probably trying to tie back into the, like, she paints houses and it's like foundation and houses. Like, I kind of get what we're trying to do on a literary sense here, but we get this whole like foundation cracking thing kind of a lot, and you know, either in these terms or similar terms at Query Letter. So ending with the safest place is her easel is a very safe choice, right? This is a very muted, neutralized ending where we kind of have to leave on a cliffhanger here. So those are kind of the main things that I would work on in this query letter. But overall, it's very interesting in terms of the plot points, but I'm just not finding them super connected.
Thank you, Carly. Okay, can you give us an indication of what was in those opening pages?
So we start with chapter one in Elaine's point of view. She has recently moved to a cabin in the middle of nowhere. We find out that she was leaving Nebraska and headed to Colorado, living in the middle of the mountains where she doesn't think anyone will be. Like, she just really has the basics, like toothbrush, her painting supplies, and that's it. She goes for a walk. She sees another woman, which she's really surprised about. The woman seems to be like also surprised by her and kind of like says, I just put on, you know, just put on coffee, like come in. And then our character kind of like runs away a bit overwhelmed. There was like a smell that was reminding her of something. And then we go to our chapter two, where we are going into her memories of being on the farm, which is the cult that is mentioned in the query letter. And we meet James, who is the boyfriend character as well. And that's kind of where we end.
Thank you. Okay. So what was your take on them?
All right. So I found the writing style pretty fragmented, right? Like that choppy style of writing where a lot of really kind of short sentences. And there was also, I found a grammatical error in the first line, which I'm always like, okay, that's like something to stumble upon. Not the end of the world, of course. But the combination of that plus the fragmented sentences, to me, fragmented sentences always feel young. They feel really young. It's like somebody who's like, you know, their brain is just popping in all these different directions. I always like the balance of some fragments or, you know, some shorter sentences together. And then all of a sudden, then we're building into these like longer, more lyrical sentences as well. So it was like, it was pretty choppy, but there were some things I really liked. There was a line I liked that said, I stared the boxes down, hoping to feel with my mind's eye, which one holds the needle and thread. You know, there were some really kind of like lyrical bits in there, but for me, the balance was a bit off in terms of the short choppy fragments and then kind of like building into these more lyrical elements. I really liked the description of setting, like Colorado felt really real to me in terms of what do the trees look like and the smells and the oxygen being thin in terms of the air quality and all of that. I really enjoyed that piece. I'll give you an example of kind of what I'm talking about with this kind of choppy wording here. So for me, something that would just, again, was a bit fragmented and choppy was, I just hadn't counted on the woman in yellow who would be living at 100,000 feet up a long dirt road other than me. There she was, so bright, so yellow, so briefly seen. I saw her before she saw me. I don't know. To me, it was just like a lot of kind of repetition of these types of things. So I would, again, as I said, like that balanced a little bit more. One thing about seeing the neighbor and then running away, I was surprised that she wasn't more concerned about what the neighbor thought of her, right? Because she's just in her own head being like, saw the neighbor, takes off. Wouldn't you be thinking, I don't know, like, what does the neighbor think of me? Now we have to have this rapport. She's going to see me again. And she kind of wants to see her again. So I, in terms of, again, she felt really young to me because She felt very in her own head, not really aware of what other people are thinking. But I didn't get the intention that she was supposed to be young, because it says, we learn in the pages, she was 17 when she visited the farm, and then she was at the farm for a while, and then it's like 10 years later than that, right? So I'm like, she's, I don't know. I just was feeling a little bit disjointed about how I was supposed to feel about this character. She's meant to be kind of stunted and in growth or adolescence, but I wasn't quite sure about that. The other thing is we don't have any timestamps other than that one mention of when she joined in 1972, when she first visited the farm. Like, are we supposed to be in the 90s? Like, I don't know. I just, again, wasn't really sure where we were in time and place other than Colorado. And I really liked the descriptions of Colorado, and I felt very connected to that element of this.
Thank you, Carly. Yeah, as you were discussing this, I was wondering if it wasn't perhaps the author's intention to show a kind of emotional or intellectual being stunted by being a part of this cult, etc. If that's kind of what they're going for, do you have advice for them on how to make that work perhaps a bit better?
You know, that's really interesting, because one of the things that I found interesting about this project is that it's pitched as upmarket. There are elements of this that are actually incredibly literary. And so I was thinking, if this is meant to be literary fiction, I would actually lean much more into that and kind of plant those seeds, because we do go between like being in the present, learning about the past pretty quickly. And the way that we jump between past and present and past is very literary. It's kind of that like start of a new paragraph, jumping into the moment, you know, that type of style of past and present. So if it is intentional, which we can always believe that it is, and that is the author's intention, even if it doesn't show up for us, I would potentially be positioning this book as more literary and kind of leaning into that a little bit more, because in terms of like from a commercial or more upmarket point of view, it was just too subtle for me.
Wonderful. Okay, thank you. Due to popular demand, I'll be running another beta reader matchup in July, with the deadline to register being the 31st of July and the actual matches happening on the 1st of August. If you're looking for once-off beta readers for your work in progress, or perhaps for other writers who might become writing group partners down the line, then this is the matchup for you. I try to the very best of my ability to match you up with writers in the same time zone and who are working in the same genre as you, and I'm always so blown away by the incredible feedback after each matchup session. I'm also pairing this one with a fundraising initiative for an awesome literary cause, so you'll be improving your own work, the work of other writers, and helping South African author Keleto Mapai finish her MFA at the University of Cape Town at the same time. Go to my website, biancamarais.com, go to the beta reader page to get more info and to register. All right, now we're going back to our guest author, who is Kirthana Ramazetti. As I said before, she's been on the podcast before with Dava Shastri's Last Day, and we're now discussing her second novel, Advika and the Hollywood Wives. So I have some questions for you, Kirthana. Before we get to them, I'm just going to read the blurb for our listeners so that they sort of get an overview, well, the jacket copy, so they get an overview of what the story is about. At age 26, Advika Srinivasan considers herself a failed screenwriter. To pay the bills and keep her mind off of the recent death of her twin sister, she's taken to bartending A-list events, including the 2015 Governor's Ball, the official after-party of the Oscars. There, in a cinematic dream come true, she meets the legendary Julian Zelding, a film producer as handsome as Paul Newman and 10 times as powerful, fresh off his fifth Best Picture win. Despite their 41-year age difference, Advika falls helplessly under his spell, and their evening flirtation ignites into a whirlwind courtship and elopement. Advika is enthralled by Julian's charm and luxurious lifestyle, but while Julian loves to talk about his famous friends and achievements, he smoothly changes the subject whenever his previous relationships come up. Then, less than a month into their marriage, Julian's first wife, the famous actress Evie Lockhart, dies and makes a shocking stipulation in her will. A single film reel and $1 million will be bequeathed to Julian's latest child bride on one condition: Advika must divorce him first. Shaken out of her love fog and still simmering grief over the loss of her sister, and uneasy about Julian's inexplicable urge to start a family, Advika decides to investigate him through the eyes and experiences of his exes. From reading his first wife's biography to listening to his second wife's confessional albums, to watching his third wife's Real Housewives-esque reality show, Advika starts to understand how little she knows about her husband. Realizing she rushed into the marriage for all the wrong reasons, Advika concocts a plan to extricate herself from Julian once and for all. Dun, dun, dun. So for our listeners, very hooky there, right? There's like a lot to hook you in. Now, Kithana, I know from the last time we spoke that you love movies, you love stars, you love celebrities, etc., etc. So can you tell us a bit about your inspiration for this novel?
Sure. So to be honest, it came from a binge watch of Real Housewives of Beverly Hills, which I find it funny to say that, but it also just goes to show you never know where inspiration is going to come from. It could come from anywhere. And I am a very much a pop culture fan and a Bravo fan. And I found myself actually not long after turning in the draft of my first novel to my editor, I just needed to decompress a little bit. And so I found myself binge watching Real Housewives of Beverly Hills. And if you're not familiar with the show, there is a housewife on the show who is married to a very famous music producer. And so during these episodes I was watching, you're actually watching the disintegration of their marriage. And they end up divorcing at the end of that season. And I was watching this thinking, well, I know for the fact this husband goes on to remarry a much younger woman who's about 30 to 40 years younger than him. And I just thought, what would it be like to be his wife? And you can actually go back and watch him and see what he was like with his previous spouse. And then the other idea I had was I knew for a fact that this husband actually had famous ex-wives as well. So I also thought, what would it be like to be the fourth wife of a very powerful man? And not only are you like 40 years younger than him, all his wives before you were famous too. And the kernel going for this novel.
Amazing. I love that. We say to our listeners, bum in chair, but that is not where inspiration strikes and that's not where ideas come from. We as writers need to interact with the world in order to be inspired by the world, which means that watching, you know, television or going on walks or binge watching whatever is actually a great way to get really good ideas and then put your bum in the chair to write about them. Now, Kithana, the last time we spoke about your debut novel, you said you had to become like a rehabilitated pantser to becoming a plotter in order to get published. So I'm assuming that means that for this book, Advika and the Hollywood Wives, you plotted it a lot more. Is that right? And how did that experience change your writing?
Yeah, so I always, after writing Dava, that was my first time plotting a novel and writing an entire outline in advance before writing the draft. But this, my new novel, Advika, it was the first time I was writing on deadline, which is a completely different experience. And I think I was just kind of writing it in a panic, mostly, because I just never wrote a whole first draft in maybe about 8 to 9 months before. So I had to figure out a method that worked for me. I realized I liked having an outline and having like a roadmap telling me what I will write next. But I honestly didn't feel like I had enough time to write an entire outline beforehand. So what I ended up doing was writing a couple of chapters at a time in an outline, then writing the draft, and then going back to the outline, writing a few more chapters, and then going back to the draft. It's kind of like laying railroad tracks before you cross them. And it ended up being a method that really worked for me. And I found that I could be adaptable to the moment, because I think writing on deadline is so different than writing a debut where you have all the time in the world. No one has any expectation of reading it. Maybe nobody even exists, versus writing to a deadline, knowing you're trying to make sure you turn your book in on time because you want your book to also come out at a certain time. Everything is so contingent once you're on contract to making sure that book comes out at a time that your publisher can promote it in the best way possible.
I love that that was your process, because, you know, for our listeners out there, one person's process is not necessarily going to work for you. Some of you get chest pain at the thought of pantsing. Some of you get chest pain at the thought of plotting. And this is like a combination of the two. So for our listeners, always find what works for you. And, you know, even if it's your own method, maybe we'll have you on the podcast in the future and we will call it the whatever your name is method, because that's, you know, a great way of finding what works for you. Something I also want to chat to Kithana about is on the podcast, Kithana, I don't want to necessarily call them rules. We like to give writers guidelines because we see emerging writers make the same mistakes over and over again. Carly and Cece see it in the submissions they get. I see it as a creative writing instructor and as someone who does manuscript evaluations. And so we say, try and stay away from X and Y because it's difficult to pull off and rather do this instead. And so I love it when I come across an author who has broken the rules, so-called rules, and who really makes it work. Now, in Dava Shastri, you gave her something that she wanted straight out the gate, We knew what her want was. There were stakes tied to it. And so, you know, we understood how to get on board with her and sort of what the impetus, the emotional impetus of everything was. What we say on the podcast is guard against a there I was minding my own business kind of opening, where the character doesn't desperately want something. We don't know what the stakes are. They're just kind of there minding their own business and something happens to them. And that yet this is what you did in this book, and you did it so incredibly well. The only thing we see in the opening scene, Advika's at the governor's ball, she's standing behind the bar, she's having to deal with a bunch of A-list celebrities, most of which are awful, let me just say. The only thing we really see her wanting is to get out of these cheap shoes she's wearing because they're causing her blisters. And yet the scene was so compelling, even though I didn't know what she wanted and even though I didn't know what the stakes were. So if our listeners are going to start with that kind of beginning, what is your advice to them? How did you make this so damn compelling without giving her something she desperately wanted straight away?
That is such an excellent question. And to be honest, I didn't really think of myself as a rule breaker until right now. But I do think what I try to do with that opening scene, that opening chapter, is Advika does want something very badly. She's mourning the loss of her twin sister, and she feels very disconnected from the world, both from her family and her friends, and the fact that she's just not where she wants to be professionally. On top of that, she is an aspiring screenwriter. So there's something to be said to be the fact that you are at the most elite Hollywood event of the year, and you're surrounded by people you'd long to be peers with, but you're there serving them drinks. So what I tried to do is, even before Advika meets Julian, I wanted to set up the idea that she's in a very interesting place in her life. She's at a very low place in terms of feeling lonely, feeling that she hasn't achieved the dream that she wants. At the same time, she's at this event, which is kind of like the fairy tale of Hollywood. This is where you see dreams do come true. She's actually seeing people walk around smiling, having their Oscars in hand. It kind of does awaken this dream she does have. So it's like, almost like she wants something very badly, but in mourning the death of her twin sister, she doesn't know how badly she wants it until she's in this very amazing setting. And so she's already feeling her dreams in a lot of ways. Like, this is what I want to be. There's actually a passage in the first chapter where she's like, I used to daydream about just giving an acceptance speech at the Oscars, but now I have a new aching dream. And it's to be here in this room, not serving drinks, but being peers and being with the Hollywood elite. So she's already in that mindset of where she's dreaming. So when Julian comes and starts talking to her and they have a conversation, then she realizes, oh, wait, maybe this is something I can actually do. Maybe this dream isn't so far away from me anymore. So I kind of want to make sure to set Advika up as a person who didn't know she wanted something so badly until it was right there in front of her, and wanting to take the reader on that journey as well, where she kind of realizes that in real time.
Amazing. And for our listeners, so if you're going to do it deliberately. Do it like Kithana has, with something very specific in mind in terms of this character's arc, in terms of their journey, as opposed to just kind of stumbling into that kind of beginning without really thinking it through, which is something that we see a lot of in terms of the submissions. One more rule that Kithana broke is we say, try and keep your chapters short. It's ridiculous that the biggest compliment I get about my own books at 3 a.m. in the morning is people are like, Bianca, thank you so much for writing short chapters. And I'm like, oh, great. Well, I'm glad that that is my big, you know, positive as a writer is my short chapters. But your first chapter was 30 pages long. And we also generally say change chapters if there's a setting change or if the characters move from one place to the next or if there's a time jump. Now, you clearly show the scene breaks, but you kept that all together in one really long chapter. And I know that you would have done that like on purpose. So can you take us through your reasoning there?
I think one of the things I realized as soon as I came up with the premise of this novel is that I had to start at Julian and Advika's meet cute, the night that they meet at the governor's ball. And I feel like what happens is I want to kind of put the reader in the shoes of Advika. She just thinks this is just another gig. She's working at another event. Her feet are hurting. She's dealing with rude customers. And suddenly this very powerful producer, fresh off his fifth Best Picture Oscar win, is talking to her and having a really deep conversation with her. And she can't believe this is happening. And then as the night goes on, he invites her to go out to the rooftop and have another deeper conversation. And then he invites her to go out to a diner and get something to eat. And it's just like, she can't believe this night is happening. It's almost like a fever dream. And she doesn't know what's going to happen next. So I kind of just wanted to not break up that whole long night they have together in chapters, but kind of just kind of make it like this thing that Advika is under this guy's spell and she can't believe this is all happening to her. And so it was really important to me to the first chapter conclude with when they kind of have that moment where they kiss and the fairy tale becomes real. But in terms of chapter lengths in general, I feel like it's always very instinctual to me. I don't really think about how long or short a chapter will be. But one of the things I realized in writing this book, I was like, at a certain point, I realized, I'm kind of writing a thriller. And I didn't even realize it, because as Advika goes on this search to find out who her new husband really is through the eyes and experiences of his ex-wives, she's just uncovering more and more information about him. So sometimes as she gets closer and closer to figuring out who he really is, the chapters get shorter and more clippy. And I think that just mirrors the fact that Advika is getting closer and closer to the truth. In general, I like to conclude each chapter on a cliffhanger of sorts. And also I make sure there's a new revelation in every chapter. So it just made sense for as Advika gets closer and closer to the truth, the chapters would kind of mirror her journey in that way.
I love what you've said about that fever dream quality you were wanting to go for, and you definitely got that. And you talk about the meet cute, but here's the thing is there were so many red flags in between the meet cute. And here's the thing, I don't read a book's jacket copy before I read it for the podcast. I like to go in completely cold. I don't like being told what to expect or having anything that's going to ruin my reading experience. And we have this meet cute and I'm like, oh my God, is this meant to be like really romantic, because this guy is kind of giving me creepy vibes. Why is he giving me creepy vibes? But yeah, he is kind of flirtatious and he is great with her. But what is it about him that's making me feel wildly uncomfortable? And so for those of you who are trying to achieve that same kind of thing, get Advika and the Hollywood Wives. There's such an amazing balance of meet cute and like, uh-oh, there's something not right happening here. And so read it to see. Kithona, we'll ask you some more questions later. For now, can we ask you to read your query letter submission?
We just registered my youngest kid for kindergarten. I cannot believe it. One of the tricky things about my kids being in French immersion school and not having French as a language myself is I'm honestly worried about how I'm going to assist with homework as they get bigger. They're young now, but I see it coming. We are honestly so lucky though to live in a city that's bilingual, and we have bilingual friends and Francophone friends. So I know it's going to be easy for our kids to pick it up. Me, on the other hand, I am worried about me. I grew up somewhere where French class was not taken seriously, and now I have to make up the difference. And that's where Rosetta Stone comes in. As the most trusted language learning program available on desktop or as an app, it really immerses you in the language you want to learn. Rosetta Stone teaches through immersion, which is a proven way to learn a language. Instead of memorizing and drilling vocabulary words, you learn by matching audio from native speakers to visuals, reading stories, participating in dialogues, and other practical language skills to fast-track your ability to communicate fluently. There are no English translations in the product. You're honestly getting trained to listen, speak, read, write, and think in your new language, which is what everybody wants. Rosetta Stone users especially love the speech recognition feature. As you practice speaking, Rosetta Stone uses advanced voice recognition technology to match your audio, the audio from native speakers, and then give you feedback on how well you're pronunciating the words so you can really hone those pronunciations. It offers 25 languages from Spanish, French, Italian, German, Chinese, Korean, Japanese, even Dutch, Arabic, and Polish. This is the best language program because they have been an expert in the language learning field for 30 years and used by millions. Thousands of companies and government organizations use Rosetta Stone to support language training online. Of all the apps, Rosetta Stone uses the best speech recognition technology, so it compares your sound waves to those of a native speaker for better feedback to improve. They have a patented speech recognition engine called True Accent, which is built into the program. As you practice speaking, you'll get feedback on how well you're pronunciating words. The other language learning apps use speech recognition to detect what you said, but Rosetta Stone tells you how well you said it compared to native speakers. It's like having a personal trainer for your accent. Think about the cost of a one-month language course. Think about the cost of one-hour private tutoring sessions. With Rosetta Stone, you enjoy lifetime membership and accessibility on desktop or app. We have a special offer for you guys. That's 50% off. That's a lifetime access to 25 language courses on Rosetta Stone for 50% off. This is a steal. Do not put off learning that language. There is no better time than right now to get started. For a very limited time, the Shit No One Tells You About Writing listeners can get Rosetta Stone's lifetime membership for 50% off. We want you guys to go visit rosettastone.com/today. That's 50% off unlimited access to 25 language courses for the rest of your life. Redeem your 50% off at rosettastone.com/today.
Are you looking for beta readers, some of whom might potentially become writing group members down the line? Are you wanting to be matched up with those writing in a similar genre or time zone so they can critique your work as you critique theirs at the same time? Your manuscript doesn't have to be complete to sign up for this 3,000-word evaluation. This particular matchup will be open to registrations from now until the 2nd of June, with the matchup emails going out on the 3rd of June. For more information and to register, go to biancamaray.com, look for the beta reader matchup page, and please spread the word. The more writers we have signed up, the better the matches will be.
Sure. Dear Cece, I'm seeking representation for my 80,000 word upmarket novel, Couples Therapy. Think Lily King's Writers and Lovers meets Taffy Broderster Ackner's Fleischman is in Trouble. When middle-aged, middle-class, mixed-race couple Naomi and Ryan start couples therapy 9 years into their marriage, Naomi is so busy advocating for their 7-year-old son with special needs, caring for her elderly parents, dealing with her insufferable mother-in-law, and fighting perimenopause symptoms. She thinks getting their marriage back on track will be a breeze, just another thing to knock off her to-do list. But she couldn't have foreseen what she would soon discover about her husband. Or could she? Is he lying about how long she slept on the floor when she was pregnant? Or is she misremembering? Is she criticizing him so much that he feels attacked? Or is he manipulating her? Has she been fooling herself all along, or is she simply trying to survive? Follow Naomi as she navigates life as a woman of color in a society which she's always had to fight, where she's never belonged, and no matter what she says or how much she shouts, it seems no one is listening. I'm a second-generation Caribbean-Canadian mixed-race Toronto-based writer who may or may not have been to couples therapy. Couples Therapy has been long listed for the 2023 Exeter Novel Prize for Unpublished Novels, and 2 chapter excerpts have been published, one in the Malahat Review and another in the Smart Set. My short stories have appeared in such journals as the Antigonish Review, Journal of Caribbean Literatures, and Macomrie. This is my first novel. Thank you for your consideration, Christine Birbal Singh.
Wonderful, Kithana. Thank you. Okay, we're going to get Carly and Cece to weigh in on the query letter. Cece, would you like to kick us off?
Absolutely. So this is clocking in at 277 words, which is very great in terms of length. And also because I'm going to give you a note that will make this a little longer, so it does mean you have room. I really love the 2 comps you're using. Like, they're such great books. So of course, this obviously makes me very excited. When it comes to the paragraph that essentially delivers the stakes, it's the one that starts with, "But she couldn't have foreseen what she would soon discover about her husband." That paragraph is basically questions. Or could she? Is he lying? Is she misremembering? Is she criticizing? Is he manipulating her? One question is fine, but we don't need all these questions, especially when they are on the generic side. So for example, is he manipulating her? I'm not entirely sure what he would be manipulating her about because we didn't get to that specific plot point. And so we could be talking about any marriage. And I know we're not. I'm sure your pages are very specific. But the job of the query letter is to have enough specificity that this will not feel like an every marriage story, but rather a very specific marriage story that's going to, of course, resonate with everyone who either has been married or not. I guess what I'm saying is that I think that specific paragraph needs to be more grounded. What exactly did she discover? This probably happened so early on that it's fair for us to know. And what are the external plot points, not the internal one she's going through, that escalate the tension? Your interiority is probably super great. This is what I thought when I read this paragraph. But right now it's time to focus on external plot points. And I really, really enjoyed the author paragraph too.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, Carly?
I agree with everything Cece had to say. Just to add something to the second paragraph, which is the when middle-aged, middle-class, mixed-race couple paragraph. So the last line is, she thinks getting their marriage back on track will be a breeze, just another thing to knock off her to-do list. And I'm kind of, I wrote like, does she really think that? Like, I kind of find that really hard to believe that her marriage is either taken such a backseat that she doesn't care or she doesn't kind of see what's going on. And then we have the next paragraph switching to, which we all know this one kind of has to be rewritten, reframed with statements, not questions. I don't know, that just, it just felt really disjointed to me because I, you know, my notes were, you know, I really love the theme of this book, but I have no idea what this book is about. The first paragraph is premise. The second paragraph is pretty unclear in terms of what's happening. And this last paragraph is very interesting, but I have no idea what the plot is. So I would just say, let's just really focus on centering the plot because we think that it's probably very interesting. And we just want to see what you can come up with.
Thank you, Carly. All right, Kirthana, we're going to ask you for an overview of what was in those opening pages and then your feedback for the author.
Sure. And I just wanted to say really quickly, as a person who has written a query letter, and when I was reading this query letter, I felt the writer holding back and not wanting to share specifics because she felt there would be spoilers. And one of the things I can say, the best thing you can do is be specific, because that's more likely to catch the attention of an agent and make them want to read your opening pages. So I can't emphasize enough. If you feel like you're holding anything back that you think is too important, it's not. Put it in the query letter. There's a reason why you want the agent to keep reading. But that said, I will now move on to discussing the pages. So the very first line of this novel is Naomi, the main character, stating, "I tell our therapist, I tend to shout." She then goes on to explain that this is her and Ryan's first time doing couples therapy in 9 years of marriage. And she says she wants to go for the sake of their 7-year-old son, Noah, who has special needs. And she doesn't want him to have to deal with a divorce when he has so many other challenges. Their therapist, Tammy, asks Naomi why she shouts. And she says she speaks loudly, no matter how she's feeling, whether she's annoyed, happy, mad, or sad. But Ryan says he feels attacked when Naomi shouts. And she explains again that she speaks loudly because she's naturally expressive and shares her feelings, unlike her husband, who she calls a Gen X white man, and therefore she believes is quiet and unemotional. She also says she can't change the way she expresses herself because she is Caribbean, and that is how she was raised. Naomi also says in this novel she chose Tammy because she hoped that as a woman, she'd be more likely to see things from Naomi's point of view. But to her dismay, it's obvious that Tammy identifies more with Ryan when she jokes that they're both unemotional people because they're both WASPs. But even worse, Tammy assumes that Naomi has emigrated to Canada, even though Naomi was actually born in Toronto. And her therapist tells her she needs to adapt to where she lives, aka when in Rome, do as the Romans do. So Naomi can't believe her therapist is saying this to her. And that is where the pages end.
Wonderful. So, wow, it sounds like we set up for quite a bit of conflict here. And we always say the more conflict, the better. Interpersonal, inner conflict, conflict with society, conflict with the world, etc. So, Kirthana, what was your take on the pages? And do you have any suggestions for the author for them to elevate the work?
Sure. So I also want to say off the bat that Naomi has such a strong voice and it immediately leaps off the page. It's just really voicey and conversational, and it makes you want to keep on reading. And I was actually thinking about this. I can't remember the last time I read something and felt a character's frustration so palpably. It's like she is simmering, but trying to keep it together. And so that I found very compelling. Throughout these opening pages, Naomi also makes these very acerbic observations of Tammy, the therapist, and they actually mirror her growing regret in choosing Tammy to be their counselor. She describes her straw-like blonde hair and her dirty pores. I just found that very effective to show not only Naomi's despair and realizing she chose the wrong therapist, but also just how observational she is. She just has a very keen eye. But overall, my biggest question coming away from these pages was, what was the breaking point that brought Naomi to therapy with her husband? As is explained in the query letter and even in these opening pages, they've been together for 9 years. And part of the reason they're seeking couples therapy is that she doesn't want to get divorced for the sake of their son. But still, there has to be some sort of incident that was so significant that drove them to try to see a therapist. Tammy, the therapist, even says she asked them for an incident versus hypotheticals. And as readers, I think we need specifics too. Of course, with a novel called Couples Therapy, Naomi's marriage is a big part of this novel. And I don't think it's enough to pique her interest in their marriage just to say they have different styles of expressing themselves because they come from different backgrounds. And one of the best things about Naomi is that she has such a sharp eye for detail, and the way she observes Tammy is so interesting and funny. But we get nothing of that in terms of her talking about or thinking about Ryan. He honestly comes off as a blank in these pages. He doesn't speak very much, and we just don't see him the way we see Naomi. In fact, I came away from these opening pages thinking I actually know more about Tammy the therapist than who Ryan is. And to be invested in the story, we just need to see Ryan. And since Naomi has such an observant eye and sharp commentary, I just wanted to see, what was Ryan doing in therapy? Was he fidgeting? Were they making eye contact? Did he dress up for this therapy session? Did he dress down? I think that would go a long way with seeing Ryan through Naomi's eyes and also giving us insight into their marriage. The only other thing I would suggest is at the beginning of these pages, Naomi essentially tells us exactly what is happening. She says, me and my husband are in couples therapy and we're going for the sake of my son. And she does that in a very interesting way, but it's a little info dumpy. And I think when you want readers to become immersed in your world from the opening chapter, you want to set a scene and kind of put them in the pages rather than being told what is about to happen. So I would just reframe those first few paragraphs and put that in the scene with the therapist. But overall, I think there's something really strong here. I think Noemi has a great voice, but we just need more specifics and more details and just know what is at stake in terms of this, the novel, in terms of their marriage.
I love that, Kethana. Thank you. Yeah. And also at this point in the marriage, I feel like people are keeping score, right? There's that saying, do not keep score if you want to keep love. But I feel like a couple at this point, they're keeping score and there's very specifics about this one did this and then this one did this and this one did that. And we do say stay away from a lot of backstory in the opening pages, but it's also fine for her to think about the last thing he did that really pissed her off and that maybe got them into therapy or whatever. So, and that can just be done in a line or two or even in a paragraph. Cece, was there anything you wanted to add there?
I was going to suggest that the writer here read The Spare Room by Andrea Bartz, because even though it doesn't begin with a person in therapy, she is alone with her thoughts on a train, and she's thinking about a fight she had with her partner, her fiance. And she doesn't tell us exactly what happened. She does think about it with specifics, sharp visuals that are very, very curiosity-inducing. And she gives us lots of emotion. So really, she frames it as a curiosity seed. So I would love to be in the scene, you know, with her thinking about the fight that got them there with these really great, sharp specifics in a way that really just ups the curiosity. Because to Kirthana's point, you know, you're not an explainer. As a storyteller, you're not an explainer. You're a seducer. And honestly, doesn't that sound way more cool? Like, who wants to be an explainer? Nobody. Everybody wants to be a seducer. So seduce us, you know? And I think that part of why the seduction isn't coming across is because I suspect this writer has what I have, which is overthinking disease. I counted, and I'm not doing this to be a bully, I promise. First paragraph, you use the word therapist 3 times, honest 3 times, shout 3 times. I'm not counting variations like therapy or shouting. Again, not pointing this out to be a jerk. Pointing this out because you probably just write and write and write and you're trying to get all the information out there. That's fine. As long as you take it pass and then you cut it back. You know, you could have said that first paragraph in probably one line. I mean, it would have been way more curiosity inducing because I know she didn't shout at her therapist. And even if I don't know, I'll figure it out later in dialogue. So you can really just rein it back in, and not as a way to withhold for aggravation's sake, but as a way to seduce the reader.
Awesome, Cece. Thank you. All right. So we are now going to go to Cece's query letter. Will you read that for us, please?
Absolutely. And before I do, because this episode is airing on July 20th, just a reminder that tonight, is the night of my Writing Relationships webinar. So if you are listening to this on the day of release, you can still sign up. Go to the links in my bio to see more. Okay, so let's do this. Dear Cece, as a devoted shithead, I am struck again and again by your sharp insights into books as well as people. I appreciate your interest in family stories, and I try hard to capture the complex tangle of identity and loyalty within families, of origin, and of choice. In my novel, The Honey Markets, an 85,000-word work of adult fantasy, this standalone novel has serious potential and will appeal to fans of The Unspoken by A.K. Larkwood and The Unbroken by C.L. Clarke. Brettley was supposed to protect her little brothers, but she did nothing as they fell into the stolen magic trade, known as the honey markets. Now she sees them only in secret, unwilling to risk her place in the wealthy court that taught her to use the mountain's magic. Her guilt and concern are swallowed by shock when thieves start draining her court's hidden magic wells. In a land where wealth is measured in liquid magic, Brettley must stop the thefts or sink into brutal poverty. Desperate to track down the thieves and save her court, she asks her youngest brother to bring her into the honey markets. Her brother, a shrewd trader of a rival court, arrives on the condition that Brettley use stolen magic to enchant items for him to sell. This cover works too well, upending the criminal netherworld, even as Brettley chases clues from squalid caves to splendid ballrooms, through treachery and murder and buried history. But as she pieces together a plot to destroy her court, she begins to suspect the very brother who was helping her. Before the wells empty, Brettley will have to choose between the court that saved her and the brother she was supposed to protect. I am a former technology project manager and now spend my days expanding the collection of nature treasures in my trunk, together with my 2 young children. With this submission, I include the manuscript's first 5 pages. Please let me know if you would like to read more. Thank you for your time and consideration. Sincerely, Miriam.
Thank you, Cece. Before we ask you for the word count and your take on that, Carly, is it time for your reveal yet in terms of which book you offered representation on?
I will never tell unless I meet you at a conference and you buy me a drink.
Okay, so everybody now look to see when Carly's going to be at a conference and make sure you meet her at the bar. Okay, Cece, so what was the word count there and what was your take on that?
347 words, great length. As a small note, I'd write the titles for the comps in all caps on the first paragraph. It helps with readability. And also, thank you so much for these very lovely compliments. Okay, plot paragraphs, because let's face it, that's what I really care about. It's all great, like so specific, so clear, you know, not focused too much on the world building, which I sometimes see in inquiry letters for fantasy, but rather on the relationships. I do have one note, though, that I think is not quite as great as the rest of this. The last line. Before the well is empty, Retley will have to choose between the court that saved her and the brothers she was supposed to protect. That's the major dramatic question, which is where your query letter is supposed to end. Amazing. But that's the same question she had in the beginning. You know, she had to either choose the court or her brothers. And so we didn't see a change. Storytelling is about change. And so understanding what's different about the second time around, making it different if you haven't, is really, really important. Because otherwise, I'm being promised a story where the central axis of the protagonist's quest is not going to move. And that doesn't sound as compelling as if it did move. A general question I have is, why are there two brothers? Because the plot points only focus on one. And so I'm pointing this out because maybe that's where the mystery of the change and the major dramatic question lies. Maybe you have to tell us about the second brother. I don't know. Maybe you don't need two brothers. Maybe you can just cut back to one. But I was confused about that. So that's something I'd work on too. But overall, really great job.
Thank you, Cece. Okay, can you give us an indication of what was in the opening pages and then your take on them?
So our protagonist is meeting with her brother at a location that's deemed to be safe because it's not super crowded and because their eyes won't out them. They have to pretend like they don't know each other. And she tells him that their brother is going to be freed and he's not reacting with the joy that she had hoped he would. They're thinking back to their childhood where they would wait together, the three of them, but her brother doesn't really remember that. And she notices him using language that's really different. She calls them cave words, which isn't like him. And then he tells her that actually the brother that's going to be released is going to be released today. He knows this because he used to be a guard, so he knows the schedule. A woman walks by. They pretend like they're not talking to each other, but she still feels safe because they're being very careful. And then the woman leaves. And after that, they go back to interacting in the safe way. And then Joth is the brother who is going to be released, appears. And then the pages end.
Okay, so what did you think of them?
I want to start by saying that the first line is really great. They met as they always did, in secret. Short, curiosity-inducing, makes me want to read more. Who is they? Why does it have to be in secret? You know, the author is not spending any time explaining, which is really, really important in my opinion when it comes to first lines. So excellent job there. I thought that there were a few things that I wasn't quite clear on. So for example, did she think her brother didn't know that the other brother was going to be released? Did she have anything to do with the release? How fresh was this information? Also, when he tells her it's going to be today, that sounds super coincidental. Right? Like, why would they meet on the day that happens to be the day of the release? Does the coincidence make her suspicious in any way? If so, that would up the tension. It felt like there was information being exchanged, but the interiority wasn't quite matching an anticipation of what the other person's agenda would be with any specificity. And I really wanted that. Really wanted to have more active goals too. Like, why is she saying this to him? And other than she wants them to be friends again, because that's really sweet and adorable. But, you know, plot. We want the juicy plot. Could she be there to convince him of something? Because I like that. Or maybe she would want to see him alone first so that they could agree on something when the brother arrives. I like that too, like that kind of strategizing, that kind of scheming. But before I go into one of my brainstorming tangents, because that's not my place, I know that. I guess I'm pointing out all these questions to say I'm not sure we're starting in the right place. It's not that it's a bad place to start, but either you really flesh out her interiority in a way that shows her agency, shows her protagonism, or I think maybe the brother is already out, you know, or maybe she's finding out the news because that way she can be surprised. She isn't really surprised in any moment here. Even when the woman interrupts them, the woman that could get them like in trouble, in serious trouble with the law, she's safe. She's safe all the time. Her interiority is like, it's okay. We're being safe in no moment. And I kept expecting disruption. I kept expecting, oh, she thinks she's safe, but actually something bad's going to happen. But no. And then the brother appears, which is, you know, nice because obviously she's going to get to see her brother again. But I guess what I'm saying is we need more tension, and tension's really important. And if Carly sings the timestamp song again, I'll sing a tension song. I promise.
Okay, so something to look forward to next time. I'll make sure these two practice. I will play the drums in the background because no one wants to hear me sing. Right, before we end today's episode, Kithana, a question from something you said earlier. So for our listeners, remember, Kithana is the author of Advika and the Hollywood Wives. And she said earlier that she started with a meet cute and at some point was like, oh, hell, I'm busy writing a thriller. So this is like a bit of a genre blend. Now, when I write a novel, I have no idea what the hell genre I'm writing in. I never think about genre when I begin, which is why I really feel for authors on the show who have to position their novels in terms of their query letters and say it's a this or it's a that. So in terms of the genre blend, Kithana, at what point did you realize that? And was it ever a problem for your publisher? Or were they like, this is great, we can kind of market it as a romance and as a thriller? Or how did they market?
That's a really good question. I think I realized it when Advika had her first huge realization about Julian and who really is in terms of how he treated his first ex-wife. And the fact that she was so like, she couldn't wait to see what would happen next in terms of what else she'll find out. And that was like, oh, I think I'm writing a thriller in the sense that she's now on a journey for information. She's actually kind of almost investigating him. And that was when I realized that was happening. In terms of how we market it and the promotion, I think it's more like we've been definitely saying it's more upmarket book club fiction, but it's been really interesting to see the reviews that call it part romance and part thriller. So I feel like even reviewers have different ideas of what this book is, which I think has been actually helpful. The best thing I've ever heard when people describe this book is they call it a page turner. And as authors, we don't want anything more than that. So I think it actually kind of worked out and also taught me if I do want to write like a standard thriller one day, maybe I can actually do it.
I love that. There should be a whole genre that's just like, it's a page turner, man. That's what it is. It's a page turner. Right. So Kithana, thank you so much for joining us. We loved having you on the show and we hope to have you back with the next book for Carly and Cece. As always, thank you so much for your insights. For our Ko-fi supporters, you will be able to see Kithana's notes as well as Carly and Cece's notes in terms of the critique and the opening pages. So for those of you who support us on the platform, head over there so you can see the written notes. We look forward to seeing you next week. Bye, everyone. And that's it for today's episode. I hope you'll join us for next week's show. In the meantime, keep at it. Remember, it just takes one yes.
Here's the thing. Ever wonder why aspiring authors spend so much time trying to crack the code about how to get published? That's because no one who's in the daily grind like me has put all the pieces together in one place. It's Carly Waters here, and as your senior literary agent on the podcast with 15 years of experience in publishing, selling books, and teaching the business of publishing, I'm here to give you the clarity that will turn this hobby into a career. Inside my course, The Author's Publishing Playbook, we have monthly live Q&A sessions to cover your specific issues, but for the rest, there are over 40 video lessons that equal 10 hours of learning with professionally edited transcripts. The course will solve all your writerly problems, except write your book for you. That's on you. My course is a masterclass designed to teach writers how to prepare, pitch, publish, and promote their book in today's competitive publishing landscape. It's for career-driven writers, aspiring and published, who want to understand how to succeed in the business of books. There are over 20 worksheets, downloads, and plug-and-play templates for editing, querying, and marketing. You get lifetime access for the entire 6-module course as soon as you purchase. As new content gets added, you have access to that as well. Don't forget, there's a mobile app on top of computer access you can learn on the go. Get started today to gain the career you've only dreamed about. And you guys get a discount. So at checkout, carlywaters.com/course, use code POD15, that's code POD15, when you check out for 15% off. That's carlywaters.com/course. Use code POD15. That's code POD15 when you check out for 15% off. See you inside the course.
Hi, everyone. This is Cece. If you're a fan of books with hooks, then you've probably heard me use the term interiority. I often catch myself saying things like, these pages need more interiority, or the interiority here needs work. And that's because interiority is a super important element of storytelling. It's what makes books unique. But as it turns out, a lot of you have questions about what exactly is interiority and how to properly weave it into stories, which is why I'm teaching my popular Writing Interiority class in a new 2-day format. We'll meet on Thursday, June 6th at 8 p.m. via Zoom to cover all things interiority, including the difference between interiority and emotions, how interiority is different from telling, how to leverage interiority into plot points, how to strike a balance between interiority and mystery, and more. And then we'll meet again for a live cozy Q&A session on Monday, June 10th, also at 8 p.m. via Zoom, in which you'll have the opportunity to turn your camera on if you choose. If you're interested, check out the link in my bio on Instagram, and I hope to see you there.